Welcome, everyone, to the Cup of Coffee podcast with me, your host, Tom Dillon. This has been recorded live at our weekly online meeting and broadcast around the world, except today it's not. Today I'm chatting to my good friend Neil Ball instead in an interview style and a change to the advertised listings because we've gone from having weekly online meetings to bi-weekly. We've now gone back to some face-to-face. And so this means there's been a gap recently. And Neil's not been brought in to fill the gap, to be clear. What he has been brought in to do is to provide some high-quality content. And but it's because we don't have online meetings every week now. So this is part of me trying to work out how to make sure we continue with what's been so far a very popular podcast. And as always, thanks all for being here and for listening. I thought I'd start. The only obvious place to start this is that before we came on, we were just chatting briefly and had some technical issues with sound. And so I was looking for something to say, you know, like testing one, two, and came across the Theophilus Thistle. Which is a tongue twister, which I will for now on try and remember and use in lieu of 1, 2, 3, testing. And it reads, you may have heard it, but I've never heard it in full, I don't think. There's different versions apparently, but it reads, Theophilus Thistle, the thistle sifter, sifted a sieve of unsifted thistles, a sieve of unsifted thistles, Theophilus Thistle, the thistle sifter, sifted. If Theophilus Thistle, the thistle sifter, sifted a sieve of unsifted thistles, where is the sieve of unsifted thistles Theophilus Thistle, the thistle sifter, sifted? Now, I'd say, without any practice, that's not bad. And you should all have a go at that. But that's the kind of high-quality property content you've all come to love and expect on here on the Cup of Coffee podcast. Good afternoon, Neil.
Good afternoon, Tom. I'm very impressed with the way you said that. I think we should do a rerun of that and maybe you should double the speed of it.
I think if people want to double the speed, the obvious way to do that is with tech.
Witness it live.
Well, we'll see how the podcast goes. And if it goes badly, then at the end, just try and lift things. I'll do it in 2x speed. So I'm sure it won't be necessary. How are you today?
I'm absolutely fantastic. I'm very honoured to be here. I feel, especially given that I'm like a pioneer. Mm. I'm forging the way ahead for your new style of podcasting on these weeks where there's nobody arriving. And you use me as a guinea pig. I've never been a guinea pig before.
I'm very honoured to have you as the first guest of this type. I genuinely appreciate you being here, not least because we found out, speaking of podcasts, that, well, I found out, you probably knew already, that you've got your own podcast and, frankly, urinating on my chips, rather, with the success, popularity and longevity of your podcast over this modest effort. What's your podcast called and what do you do on it?
Well, my podcast is called The Entrepreneur Way, and I suppose the essence of it is I interview other entrepreneurs trying to figure out what are the secrets to success.
Well, that's that.
Yeah, it's quite interesting just asking people lots of questions about how they've become entrepreneurs and their journey as entrepreneurs and where they see themselves going in the future. And I started it about... I was in the throes of starting it about, was it 6 years ago? About 6 years ago, I think it was, I started in 2015, the back end of 2015, I decided to start my podcast. And I eventually had trouble getting people on it at first. Nobody wanted to come on it because I'd had nobody on it. So I had this sort of dilemma where people would say, well, who's been on your podcast? I'm like, nobody, but you could be the first person. And eventually I got it started. And I think I went live on it in the February 2016. Mm. And I started interviewing people on a daily basis. So I published 7 days a week. And I did that continuously until I got to my 2000th episode. I almost actually backed off at 1,000 episodes. But then I thought I was being a bit of a wimp at 1,000 episodes. I thought there's more in than this. I can just keep going. So I just kept going. But when I got to 2,000 episodes, I figured at that point I'd gone down this road of interviewing all these people, and I felt there was just other things I wanted to do, and it was taking up quite a lot of my time. So I've eased off now. I just do it once a week.
Yeah, I can strongly recommend the once a week format. A few things spring to mind there. One is, first of all, it's very impressive. Second of all, is that I probably agree that after 2,000 episodes, you should have worked out the entrepreneur way. Or if you haven't, you're not going to get it. Like, yeah, you've either got exactly. Hang.
Yeah, I wasn't sure at 1,000, but I've got it figured out.
Another 1,000, and I've really nailed this. So I don't
want to jump to any premature conclusions about it.
No. Whenever we have a problem in life, the best thing to do is interview 2,000 people about the correct way forward. Although that's what government do, and they seem to make a lot of mistakes. So maybe that's a bad thing to do. In fact, it's rubbish. It's not good at all.
Nothing compared with government. How low could you get, Tom?
Yeah, sorry about that. Especially early on in the podcast. I should also point out, because that sounded a tiny bit like there was some sort of sponsored, oh, Tom's got Neil along because they both want to talk about Neil's podcast. Nothing could be further from the truth. I had to, first of all, rip it out from Neil. He wasn't going to tell me, and I sort of tickled it out from him pre-podcast recording. Second of all, I only found out about it 5 minutes ago. So there's to say there's no money changed hands on me recommending Neil's podcast is understatement of the century. So, but I haven't even listened to it, but I certainly will be going checking some out. Once I get a chance, what's a one you've done recently maybe that you'd recommend? I mean, that's a bit unkind maybe because it puts other ones in the shade, doesn't it? But are there any that stick out from recent recordings?
I think that's quite a difficult question to answer, really, because I find that different people get different things out of different episodes. So it depends where you are and what you're looking for from a particular person who's on that podcast, because most of the people who I've interviewed are not anybody you would have heard of. One or two of them you might have heard, some of the people I've had on there if you're in certain circles, then, but there's nobody who's mega famous. I've not got anybody like Richard Branson or anyone like that on there where I could say, sure, Well, I've interviewed Richard Branson or Alan Sugar or anyone like that. I've not done that. And so I think you've just got to listen to them. I mean, I tend to prefer, from my point of view, I tend to prefer the longer episodes because I don't restrict the time. I let people just answer the questions I ask, and it takes as long as it takes to get to the end. And some of my longer episodes are the ones that I've tended to enjoy most, but not always. It really depends on the individual. I think you need to listen to a number of them, Tom, rather than me try to give you something and say, you will enjoy this. I think you've got to figure it out for yourself.
Do I need to listen to all 2,000, or is it okay?
I think that would be advisable, yeah.
Well, for those who are still with us and not getting started on that, because...
In fact, once you've done that, I'll do a follow-up podcast with you and we'll find out which one you found the most enjoyable.
Yeah, I think if I listen to all 2,000, frankly, if anybody does, that should qualify them to be a guest on the show. they could, at the very least, sort of summarise it for everybody else. Some people might be listening to thinking, hang on a minute, isn't this a sort of what we're talking about here? It's about podcasts, isn't this a property thing? Which it is, and we're getting to that right now.
It's so, actually totally related though, because ultimately entrepreneurship is about taking money, investing in something with time or money or both, and putting all these resources together to create something that's bigger and better. And that's what you're doing with property. So it is the same.
Well, I'm glad you've tried to tie that together and sort of tie it back a bit, because it looked like we'd wandered off the topic. So,
I thought it was important.
Thanks, man. You can come on more often. Property, from without wanting to steal your answer to your first question, you kind of got into it by accident, didn't you?
I've always had I have a vague memory from when I was a teenager. I came up with this idea at some point when I was a teenager. I think I found out when I was a teenager how much you could buy a terraced house for back in the 1980s. I don't know. I can't remember now, but that's the thing. But it seemed quite cheap at the time. And
seems quite cheap now.
Yeah. And it would. Yeah. And I have this recollection of having this scheme where I thought, well, if I could somehow persuade my dad to buy one of these properties, I could do it up and make some money. Unfortunately, he didn't buy into my plan. So I almost became a property tycoon as a teenager, but didn't quite make it.
I remember on a similar thing, albeit a few years later, because I'm younger than you, just to make that point. But I think I'm younger than you. I hope I'm younger than you. We sat down as we entered uni, so this is 98, and we sat down and went, we're about to spend loads of money and give a lot of money to Gordon Brown as the Chancellor at the time for our student loans and expenses and course and all this. And this was before 3 or 9 grand fees, but it's still going to cost us a fortune. Could we just not pool our resources, sack off further education and buy a flat in St. John's Wood? I could really run down, you know, one bed type of thing. Excuse me. And then wait for property prices to go up. And had we done that, we'd have, well, we'd be millionaires many times over, if especially if we'd reinvested it. But that goes for a lot of investment things looking back in the past, doesn't it? You kind of, part you, it's nice to reminisce and go, oh God, actually, it's not right nice to reminisce. It's painful to reminisce, but it's better. It's often better just to focus on what's happening now and what you can do with your learnings, isn't it? I guess
it is. I think one of the challenges is, I think when you're younger, you're very much guided by what you see other people doing. And when you're in education, you're told that you're programmed to have a job. Yeah. That's what education is all about. Everything is based around, oh, well, if you work hard, you get good results, you'll be able to go to a good university, you'll be able to get a good job. So you think that's the only route in life. And actually, they've only told you half of the tale. And I've discovered through interviewing all these people that there's lots of people who didn't do, but I've met lots of people who didn't do particularly well in school, who've done very well in life, because it's not academic skills are not what you need in life. And unfortunately, school doesn't really give you the option or put the idea in your mind that maybe you could go and become a property investor, or you could become an entrepreneur, or you could run your own business in some form or other. Yeah. I think that's quite unfortunate, really. But
it's very sad. I'm still working on, I wish I'd done more on it. Put it in my big bag of regrets here. But I'm still working on it, which is to try and get financial education into schools, and just start with a pilot project. And I know I'm not alone in this. I know there's quite a few entrepreneurs, some bigger names than me. I think Simon Zucci and Roger Hamilton, have I got the name right? I've been looking at similar things, and hopefully with more success than I've had. And there are some schools which focus on that, you know, kind of different, very much sort of outside of the normal curriculum type of schools. But yeah, the idea of going back to my old school, which is kind of the daydream that I have, and saying, right, kids, who's in your 11 years, if they're 16, say, of formal education has ever mentioned how to make cash? The answer will, of course, be nobody. And I say, right, well, I'm not an expert on it, but it'd be useful to talk about, wouldn't it? At least once before we, you know, given the amount of time we talk about French and geography and history. And I'm not talking those subjects down, they're important stuff, but so's how to survive in the world. And that seems to be overlooked. I remember watching a thing about soldiers, and I've never been in the forces or anything, but they were saying that they teach soldiers very brilliantly how to survive, because that's a very important skill. As they teach them all the things they need to know how to survive, but they do not teach them how to live, especially after they leave the service. And they don't teach them any of those skills. That's why you see such large, ridiculously large rates of homelessness and things, and mental health problems being suffered by ex-service men and women. I sound like I'm doing a charity fundraiser here, don't I? But a lot of that's because of the skills that they have and have not been taught. And I think the same is true of financial education in school.
Yep, no doubt. People leave school financially illiterate, I think.
Yeah, it's really sad and unnecessary. That said, you managed to, and the fact you couldn't persuade your dad to buy a terraced house or five, you managed to do something. So what did you do?
Well, I went to work in a nightclub, of course. What else would you do?
Right.
And actually, that was a good springboard for me, because it got me stuck in a dead end, and eventually it gave me the stimulus to be able to go and start a business, which is what I did. I started a business selling consumer electronics and did very well. And as that business grew, it needed buildings, and I'd always figured I'd rather be the person that the first two buildings I operated out of, I rented. And then I bought a building, and then I bought another building. And I just kept buying buildings. So initially I was buying buildings to support my business, but eventually I got to the point where I had surplus cash. I was doing very well back in the back end of the 1990s, I had a lot of surplus income, and I realized that I really could go and buy those terraced houses all of a sudden. So my first three houses I bought, I knew somebody who knew an accountant who wanted to get out of being a landlord, and he sold me his three houses. I think I paid him about £60,000 for these three houses. nice little each starting total. Point. Total.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah. And that was the beginning of it. And then I started, after that, I then started looking at, well, it's a combination of things because I still had my commercial properties because I needed more and more space. So I was buying warehouses for my business and retail premises for my business. And at the same time, I was buying domestic sort of normal buy to let kind of stuff, which I was slowly beginning to grow. And I then discovered auctions, and the auctions in the 1990s were back end of the 1990s were, it was sort of a nice place to go. There wasn't that many people interested in them back then, and they were in person, and sometimes not a lot of people would show up, which was good. And you could get a nice property for £15,000-£20,000 at an auction if you wanted to buy somewhere. In fact, I used to go sometimes, and they used to have properties in Blackburn, Burnley, that were £3,000-£5,000, and no one would buy them. And I think to myself now, those same properties are probably selling for, well, what, £60,000 or £70,000. I should have filled the boot with those, I think, and bought loads of them, but I didn't.
Yeah, and, can I have you a minute, because I'm sobbing into my tissues over it. For £3,000-£5,000.
This is where we're at a disadvantage, that people can't see those tears rolling down your face, Tom.
We'll have to start the Joe Rogan thing. It's an EDU podcast. I think he has video on his, doesn't he? But we haven't got the budget for that. My dad wants to buy a house for £300. He wants to turn down a house for free.
I don't think he'd do that.
Yeah, that's because he's an idiot. No, he's not. If he's listening, which he's not, then he's not an idiot. But he probably is for that. Not least because the house is worth over £250,000 now. But anyway, that good news. That's going well. Usually, when things go well, at this point in the film, if this was a Hollywood film, things would start going badly. Something would go horribly wrong. You'd end up having to sell everything up and then start again. Is that what happened here, or did it all just chug on nicely?
No, it carried on well. Eventually what happened was the auctions, early 2000s, people started getting a bit more excited about properties and it became increasingly expensive. I think one of the challenges in property is that when you come into the market, wherever you come into the market, you get a perspective of the market and you get used to buying at that level in the market with whatever method you're using. And when it starts to change, you still want to carry on buying as you used to buy. Yeah. And therefore you buy less and less of them. That's what happened. I bought less and less of them. I think early 2000, I bought about 2002, I think it was around about 2002, I bought a 30,000 square foot warehouse. So that kept me busy for a little bit of time. And at the same time, I had another property. I'd got this other property, which when I first bought, I'd got another warehouse I bought. And when I bought it, I actually made a mistake. I bought this warehouse and didn't realize it didn't have some of the land that was next to it when I bought it, which was actually going to make it difficult for me to take deliveries. But it turned out that that piece of land was about to go to auction just after I'd bought this property. So the timing was beautiful. And I was about to go to the auction on the day of the auction. And I thought, well, I'll just ring them up to make sure that this property is still in the auction. So I rang the auction company and said, I'm interested in this plot of land. Is it going to still be in the auction today? He said, oh, no, it's been withdrawn. I went, oh, that's a pity. I said, well, has someone bought it? Now you might think to yourself, well, that's a silly question to ask. As it turned out, it hadn't been bought. They'd taken it out of the auction because some gentleman who was unfortunately in hospital had put an offer in which had been accepted, but he couldn't get to the auction company to pay for it. And I said to him, well, look, so you've not sold it and you don't know if this person's going to buy it off you. How about if I come down today and put money on the table and pay for it? And being an auctioneer, he couldn't resist it. So I ended up with that plot of land. But then when I bought the plot of land, I then discovered that whoever owns that plot of land has to give that has to give rights of access to somebody who owns the building next door. So quite a complicated parcel of three pieces of property and land. Mm. And next door was like an old schoolhouse. And the guy who ran that was actually the guy who was in hospital, it turned out. He tried to buy the plot of land that I ended up gazumping him on. And he owned this schoolhouse. He was about 70 years old. And I wanted to buy this land off it. I wanted to buy his building off him, which was an old schoolhouse from the Victorian times. But he was running a some kind of sheet metal company out of there at the time. And he was quite happy working in his late 60s, early 70s. And I got to a point where I kept ringing him that every year, this was back in the late 90s. And for a number of years, every 6 months or so, I'd ring this guy up and say, are you ready to sell yet? You should be retiring. It's about time you took up golfing or something and go and enjoy yourself. You don't want to be working at your age. I was trying to get him to sell me his land, because I'd got this expansion plan for the whole of this, my warehouse at the time. But he just wouldn't sell. And he wanted me to pay him a lot of money so he could go and retire. I think he wanted to play golf in the Caribbean, whereas I thought he could play golf in Wigan or something, and it was going to cost him less money. So, and then one day he ended up, it turned out I think just after I'd bought this 30,000 square foot warehouse, it turned out that he had, his business went bust, I think. And at that point, I got a phone call from him saying that he was ready to sell his building at that point. And I was thinking, well, that's great. I've just bought another warehouse because I wanted this before, but I wasn't really planning on buying it. But I bought it in any case, so I ended up buying that as well. So, yeah, nice little thing. I put it all together. I had all those three. So I ended up with one warehouse, a schoolhouse, and a plot of land. So I had about an acre of land in the end with that.
That's good, isn't it?
And so, yeah, that kept me busy whilst the auctions were going a bit quieter. And then in about 2000, I can't remember exactly what happened. I think I got to a point where I stopped buying too many because I just didn't like the way I didn't like auctions. Auctions are they're insidious things. You sort of sit there and you have this, you sort of sit there persuading yourself to spend a bit more. Because you sit there and you think, well, I'm only going to bid up to this price. And then you get to that price and then someone outbids you by £500. So you think, well, it's only £1,000 more. Well, go on then, I'll do it. So you put your hand up again. And then the other person goes up by 500 quid and you think, well, I was in for that 1,000. Whoa, Max, we're going for 2 now. And before you know where you are, you spent more money than you wanted to spend. And maybe you even overspend. So I think it plays on your human psyche of, it almost becomes more about winning than getting a good deal sometimes if you're not careful. You've got to be very careful when you go into an auction to make sure that you're quite clear about how much you're prepared to go to and then stopping at that point. Yeah. That's actually very difficult to do. It's like a drug.
Yeah, it's easy to say that and hard to do, isn't it? Everybody says it. Everyone finds it difficult to do, and they're certainly set up like it's not. This isn't the first auction that this auctioneer company's run, so they are very careful and clever, like casinos are. And there's a lot of psychology at work for making sure that the bids go high because that's in their interest.
Yeah, well, I think we're wired in a way that our minds, you have this desire to buy that property, and your gut instinct says buy it, yeah. Go on, go for it, you know, you haven't got time to think about it. But then whereas your logical mind takes a bit longer to think, and I think the problem with auctions is it sort of bypasses your logical mind to some extent, so you just end up caught in this frenzy of bidding.
Yeah, there's a great book called The Chimp Paradox, isn't there? And you may have read it, but it seems like one of those things where it enables your chimp brain to make the decisions, and the chimp brain is fast, but it's not necessarily the best brain to be making decisions about what to spend hundreds of thousands of pounds you haven't got on.
So there you go. That's the takeaway for today for everybody, isn't it? Auctions are full of chimps.
Auctions are full of chimps. Going back a stage, I thought you made a very insightful point about the fact that everybody sees the market. I'm changing your words here, but everyone sees the market as two-dimensional. It always reminds me of a flat man or woman seeing the world, seeing a three-dimensional world. So when you come into the market, you see it as like a two-dimensional image, like bang, that's what the market is. And it is on that day, on the day you start looking at it. So houses are $2,000, houses are $10,000, houses are $1,000,000. Whatever they are on the day you happen to look at it. And then from that point on, that is kind of your fixed point. No one talks about this, at least I've not heard them do it, which is, it's then very difficult. When prices go up $5,000 and $10,000, you can kind of go, okay, well, things used to be, let's talk about my example. When I was buying houses, started buying houses, they're maybe 50, 60K. And when they get to say 70 and 80, you think, oh, that's a lot. But okay, you know, prices have gone up. I get it. This isn't like, I'm not getting ripped off. It's just that all the houses on the street are now worth 70, 80K. But when it gets to 100 and there used to be 50 and it wasn't that long ago, it's just really difficult because you, and we all see the market on that day as like a two-dimensional image, almost like a picture. That's the market, except it's not. The market's three-dimensional. It came from a different place. It's going to a different place. But the way our brains work, or certainly the way my brain works, by the sound of it, yours too, is that you see that two-dimensional image. And it's very difficult to move with the times. And that sounds, oh, that's a funny story. That's a little vignette to put in the podcast. Yes, but it makes a massive difference to, for example, important things like the size of your portfolio. Because I've definitely had moments where I've gone, I'm not paying $80,000 for that, or $120,000 for that, because it was worth $60,000 2 years ago. And you kind of kick yourself and think, I should have bought it 2 years. I'm not buying it now. It'll come back down in price. It might do. But I think the best advice, and again, kind of trying to tap into your or people's rational brains, is to say it might do, but you're better off. And I'm stealing this from an esteemed friend of Cooper, Julie Talbot, who says, you know, you got to just keep buying all the time. If you're a property investor and you want to be a property investor for the rest of your life, for example, then you need to buy 1 a year, 5 a year, 10 a year, and not worry too much about whether the year is overpriced or underpriced, because over a 50 year career or a 70 year career, that will even itself out. Whereas if you stop, then you stop. And it's much more difficult than to restart, because you lose momentum.
I think it's not just, I actually think you're probably right there. I think because if you keep buying every year, it's almost like being in the auction where you keep persuading yourself up by 1,000 or 2 or 3,000 each year. Whereas if you stop and then you stay out of it for 5 or 10 years and you come back and you're going, how much are those properties now?
Yeah.
And there's a massive rise. And actually, I think the other thing I found is that the rent doesn't follow the value of the property either. Because when I think back to those days when I was buying properties in auctions for 15, 20, maybe £25,000, the amount of rent I was getting for those properties compared to the value of the property, if one of those properties is now worth £100,000, I don't get five times the rent.
Yeah, or anything like it.
And this is the complication with the property market, because the other thing that's affected it is the interest rates, because I think as the interest rates have come down, the value of the properties have gone up. I'm doing beautiful hand gestures here that people won't get to experience.
I'll do a sketch graph to publish.
Oh, that's good. And I think it's quite a complicated dynamic, ultimately, when you think about it, because people might think, oh, well, it was great buying properties 20 years ago or 30 years ago, because look how cheap they were, but interest rates were a lot higher. So actually, it you make money in a different part of the deal, I suppose, in some respects, because at one time you'd spend a lot more money on your mortgage than you spend on it now. And so anyway, so what happened then was eventually I think I got distracted. I think I my business was doing extremely well for a short period of time, and I had to deal with that. And I was buying extra warehouses and things and doing them up. And then in the, I think, I can't remember exactly, probably about 2004, maybe, I discovered something somewhere that invited me to a 2-hour presentation to learn everything you'd never known about property before. And I went to this presentation, and a number of speakers stood on the stage and really did tell me stuff. I thought I knew a bit about property, but they had a different perspective on it and they looked at it different ways. In fact, I remember at that point, they described a certain type of landlord who owned a certain type of property and described them as slumlords. And I thought, slumlord? I'm a slumlord. all these I've got all these terraced houses. I'm a slumlord.
Did you get some business cards printed up?
Yeah, come and rent one of my properties. Number one slumlord in Bolton. No, I didn't. And they started talking about different ways of buying properties. And at the end of it, they tried to sell you on a weekend. And I signed up for it. It was about £2,000 or £3,000. I can't remember how much it was. And I went to some hotel near Manchester Airport and ended up being part of, you may have heard of them, I think, Instant Access Properties, run by Jim Moore and Brad Rosser and some other people who, they certainly educated me. I think I learned quite a lot from them. I also questioned some of the stuff that they did. And I think this is perhaps an important thing here, is that even when you go and do someone's course, I think you've always got to be able to not necessarily follow everything that they say, because they might, just because it worked for them, it might not be right for you. So for example, Instant Access Properties were buying, they were encouraging people to go and buy apartments everywhere. And because I'm probably a bit of a rebel in some ways or other, I sort of ignored that part of their advice. But I actually thought to myself, well, there seems to be a lot of apartments going up everywhere in the cities and everything. And I just thought, maybe there's too many of them. I'll stick with houses. But I used the principles that they taught at the time, which was buying new, not buying off plan, but they did talk about buying off plan, actually. That was one of their strategies, and it works quite well, that especially when the price of the property market's going up, it could work quite well. But one of the things they talked about was
buying new be buying and betting up better than buying old? Because you can do different lending, or
the thing is, when you buy, the way they put it was, well, when you're buying old, you become a property maintenance person as much as any, as well as a property investor.
Right.
So you start getting involved in having to put new, because let's face it, you buy an old terraced house, you're going to have to put a new roof on it, because quite often they don't have any felt under the slates, or the nails in the slates are going rusty and all the tiles start falling off the roof and you get dampness problems. Yeah.
Or they don't have any slates.
Yeah. And it's, you get a different kind of tenant. I think it was the way they talked about it was, well, you get a better class of tenant, you get a less hassle tenant. Yes, you'll make less money out of them in some respects, but you'll spend less money on them because you're not having to maintain the properties.
It's slightly less work for a lower return. But
it sort of made sense to me at the time. And I then started going to a number of developers with a view to buying properties in bulk at the end of their financial year. I wondered if I had a walkout at that point, Tom. And I went to develop, well, the plan, really my plan was to go to property developers like Barrett and various other companies at the end of their financial year. So I think Barrett's end of financial year, if I remember right, I think it was either the end of June or the end of May. I can't remember what it was. And then you had the 6 month, at the end of the 6 month period, at the end of the financial year, because they're a PLC, they like to go and report to the city about their results of how many property sales they've got. And they like to not have many properties on the books, completed properties on the books. They like to get rid of them. So if you can go to a property, the way it worked back then was, if I went to a property developer and said to them, well, I want to buy 6 or 10 properties off you this month, within the next 4 weeks, what can you do for me? Can you do me a deal? They would, at the time, they were prepared to give me a reasonable percentage discount off their normal asking price for it. And the clever thing back then was that you could also do it as a cashback on completion, and that didn't need to be divulged to the surveyor or the mortgage company at the time. So what that meant was, if you could go and buy a property, say it was £200,000, and you were getting 15% cashback on completion, you'd go to the mortgage company and say, I'm buying this £200,000 property, I'd like a mortgage on it, and they might give you a 80% mortgage on it. So you've got to find £40,000 deposit. So you put your £40,000 down, you do all your legals, and at the end of it, the property developer would then give me back £30,000. So it actually only cost me £10,000 to get into that deal for a £200,000 property. Sometimes I did deals where I actually got a big enough discount that by the time I'd purchased the property, I was putting money in my pocket and it didn't cost me anything to buy the property. Those were I got a few properties where I did that. And that was a strategy I followed for quite a while. And I went to different property developers for a number of years doing that, buying up the properties they couldn't sell at the end of 6 months or end of 12 months. And I had a budget of money that I was able to go and do that with for a period of time. A bit of a, to do that, you do need to have quite a bit of, I guess, surplus cash to do it somehow. So as long as you can raise the cash to do it, then maybe you can still do it now. I don't know how it would work now. I've not tried doing that for a long time. Maybe you've come across people who still do it, but I haven't.
No, sure. I have. Albeit, there's different ways, different tickles, and some things have changed and become not allowed, and other things have become allowed, and so on and so forth. But the principle the main principle of developers looking to get rid of stock at near year end is still alive and well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think they did change it. The cash back on completion thing. There was some change that meant that the developer has to now tell the surveyor that there's going to be cash back on completion.
Yeah.
And the surveyor will then take that into consideration in the valuation. Really, it shouldn't make any difference. I think it's a bit, if you think about it, if the surveyor is truly using their skills as a surveyor, they should be able to come along and look at that property and say, yes, it is worth £200,000. And whether I'm getting a discount on it, if I'm buying bulk or not, shouldn't influence their report on whether or not it's worth £200,000. But the reality is, once they know that you're getting that cash back on completion, you can bet they'll put the value down as 170,000 and not 200,000. So
you can absolutely. And by the way, I agree with you. But as we both know, it's not to do with the surveyors. They don't care. It's because they're the person paying the piper calls the tune, and the person paying the piper in this case is the lender, and they want to see that the investor, in this case you, has got skin in the game. And so they strongly lean on the surveyors to tell them what they need to value it at.
I understand that as well. But even that, I mean, you having skin in the game is an interesting concept, that if you actually think about it, because while I understand it, at the same time, the lenders create the market. The more money they lend, the more people will buy, the more the value of the properties go up. And they're quite happy to be in the market to experience that extra business they get as a result of that. But as soon as they decide, like in 2008, for example, when all the banks realized, well, quite a few of the banks had problems, people like Lloyds and the Royal Bank of Scotland, and they ended up in a position where they stopped lending. The market became flat. Everything stopped happening in the market. People, and the values of properties dropped. And all of a sudden, what do? They then come after investors who, if an investor can't keep up the payments, they want the investor to pay the difference between what it was well valued at previously and what it's valued at now, if it isn't enough money to pay the mortgage. But they create the market in the first place by their lending, and the current circumstances are created. For example, in, say, 2008, 2009, those circumstances were also created by the banks, and yet they blame the investors, when in reality, they created the problem because of their own ineptitude in what they were doing.
There you go. Value for the listeners. I'm not sure people do with that, but value, heartfelt opinions are always welcome. speaking of 2008-09, when someone's been investing since before then, I'm always secretly tempted. What I really want to get to is 2008-09 and find out how badly they got hurt by the crisis. Not in a nasty way, hopefully, but just in a... I'm always interested to see what people's experiences of what has been the toughest recent time in property has been. What was yours?
I think 2008 and 2009, it was a mixed experience for me. I think one of the things that I experienced with that was, and this is, I sort of look at what's happening. I've been happening in the last 12 or 18 months. And I mean, in many ways, it just feels to me like it was in 2007, 2008. Everybody's thinking that at some point something's going to change, but they keep buying because everything looks good. And I think we've got to that point now. I mean, I've literally watched the prices of properties where I am in Bolton and around and about. And in the last 12 months, certain types of properties have gone up a silly amount, really, probably more than they're reported to have gone up in, because obviously they look at averages. And I think what happens is you, if you care, if you're not in it for the long term, what you can end up doing, you can end up getting trapped, because if you buy at the top of the market and then there's an adjustment in the market, like what happened with 2008 and 2009, then the property prices then fall and you can end up in a position where you're stuck with a property that you can't afford to sell. And that's a position that you don't really want to be in, but there's no way of knowing whether that situation's really going to happen again. Everybody thinks, well, it won't happen again. That was previous and it won't happen now. But I think certainly from my buy to let stuff, it didn't really make much difference. It did mean I've had a certain amount of perspective on the new build properties, and I probably wouldn't recommend that strategy, actually, thinking about it. It didn't really work out as well as I would have hoped, because I bought probably too high. Then there was an adjustment in the market. And on top of that, with some of my developments, there's so many properties in the they've built so many properties for quite a number of years that there was a constant supply of new houses. Well, who wants to buy a second-hand house when you can buy a new one on the same development? Everyone wants the new ones. So the premiums on the new ones, and once you've had your new house for 10 years or something, it becomes another older house. So therefore, it takes time for the market to really start to pick up the prices again. I think it's beginning to happen now. I've had, my values have increased quite nicely over the last couple of years, and it's beginning to look a little bit better. One of the other things that I didn't mention was that I'd figured that I actually wanted to be I figured at some point I wanted to be a property baron. That was my plan.
Well, an upgrade from slumlord.
Yeah. I figured that was it. Yeah, I think slumlord really psychologically affected me, and I think I had to become a property baron. It sounded better. So. And part of my plan was to also buy properties in foreign properties as well.
So you're going to be a baron, isn't it, I think?
Yeah. I wanted to be an international baron, yeah. And so I started buying properties there were some properties I bought in the US that were about a mile from, I think Disney was creating, I always get mixed up, which is the Florida Disney. They were putting a new West Gate into Florida. And there was this development that was going up that was about a mile from the West Gate, which was on the main road to Disney. It was being built in a swamp. And you know, it sounds very nice, but actually it was like a nature reserve. It was beautiful. And I invested in, we invested in quite a few of those. We bought a number of those. And I also looked at Spain, and at the time I got giddy with the 20% year-on-year increases that were going on, thinking this looks good, keep going on like this, this is amazing. So I decided to buy a number of properties in Spain, and I did the same in Portugal, and it seemed like a good idea. And then And the Spanish and Portuguese properties came with rental guarantees at the time. So everything, all the numbers seem to stack up quite nicely. You look at your mortgage, you look at your rental guarantee, and you go, oh yeah, it all pays for itself. That's very nice. I can have those properties paying for themselves, and it works out quite nicely. The American one didn't quite work out for me. I bought into the development off plan, and the money should have gone into some kind of escrow, or it did go into some kind of escrow. But in 2008, the developer went bust, and it turned out that somehow my safe money that was in the escrow wasn't as safe as I thought it was. And a chunk of money that I'd put into that ended up lost. The Spanish properties for me were just a disaster, quite honestly. I didn't, once the rental guarantee things ran out, I then discovered the reality of the market and complete overdevelopment in the area of Spain that I purchased in, and the levels of rent I could get on those properties. Well, holiday lets to me just seemed like a whole pile of hassle. Maybe they were just being poorly managed, but whatever which way, they didn't work for me, because I felt like everybody enjoyed staying in my property that much that they liked to put part of my property in a suitcase as they went home. So I'd end up with knives and forks disappearing and towels and all sorts of things. And people would leave the place in a mess, or they wouldn't look after it, or it'd get damaged. And it's just a whole pile of hassle. So in the end, I ended up doing them on longer term lets. And you just can't get any money for them. I mean, the amount of money you can rent a terraced house for in the UK, I was renting a 3-bedroom villa with a pool kind of thing. It was just ridiculous. Similarly in Portugal, similar kind of story. So they didn't work out very well. So that was definitely a downside to the 2008. And tourism has obviously had another hammering over the last couple of years with all this COVID stuff, which has not helped, and that's reduced my rents again, made it very difficult. So I'm not going to be rushing into being an international property baron very quickly. I don't think it's a change of strategy on that. I'm definitely not up for that.
Stick with Bolton Baron. So then bringing us, I think that's a nice little canter through. So then that brings us up to screaming into the modern day against both of our wills. where do we find ourselves today? Are you buying at the moment, or happy with what you've got, or a bit of both, a bit of neither? Selling?
I've explored a number of different possibilities over the last 12 or 18 months, and I've put a few offers in on quite a number of properties, and I've figured if I don't put any offers in, I'm not going to get anything. So let's make sure I put some offers in. I've been called a few names for some of the offers I've put in sometimes, and not necessarily now. I've been accused of trying to steal the property as the price I'm offering, and I'm sort of potentially I'm still buying, but it's got to be at the right price. And I think that's the challenge. I'm trying to find my angle now, actually. I think that's where I'm at. I've explored different avenues of how I thought I could make it work. And there always seems to be something that makes it difficult. For example, I was trying to buy a pub probably about 12 months ago. And this pub was about 350 square meters, something like that. So it's quite a large pub. And it was being sold by a chain of pubs, and about 150,000 quid. And I'd got them to agree that they'd take an offer of 125,000 quid on this building. The problem is that I wanted to turn it into a HMO. I could see it could probably turn into something like a 14 or 15 bed HMO. I'd got it all figured out of how I could do it. And it would have been a very nice, if it had actually made, the numbers would have worked in such a way that I could have purchased it, refurbished it, refinanced it, and got all of my cash back out of it. It would have been that good. but I had one slight issue, and that was that the owner of the pub wouldn't do, I wanted them to do a conditional exchange on getting planning permission to do what I wanted to do, and they wouldn't do it. And having previously bought a property, I bought a retail place, I bought a building many back in, I can't remember, early 2000s, I think it was, or mid 2000s, I bought a retail showroom down in the Midlands, and that was a building that I'd purchased, which I used to sell hot tubs. And it was a building where it didn't have any use. It had been used for various commercial things over the years, but it never had planning permission for it because it'd been in existence as it is before they'd started giving use consent on buildings. So I purchased this building thinking, well, I'm going to turn it into a retail showroom. And my plan was to knock this building down and to redevelop it and put a nice, shiny new building in its location, which would have been a really nice showroom. And unfortunately, the planning department had a different plan for me, and they turned down my application. And I then had to, so I then ended up getting a planning consultant in, and I appealed their decision, and I went as far as I could with that, fighting it as much as I could, but there was just no way they were going to back down on it. And I ended up with a building that I purchased, which I couldn't do what I wanted to do with it, unfortunately, which was quite unfortunate. So having experienced that, I wasn't prepared to take a flyer on this pub because I didn't really want to, I didn't fancy owning an empty pub. In fact, I found another person who, when I was looking at pubs, I discovered somebody who had done that very thing. They'd bought a pub thinking they could get planning permission to turn it into a HMO. And they just bought it thinking they'd be okay. And now they're trying to sell that. I think this last time I checked, they were still trying to sell that pub that they'd purchased because they can't turn it into the building they wanted to turn it into because the council has decided it has to stay as a pub. So I didn't want to get into that position. So,
oh, very sensible. Yeah, yeah. Interesting. Interesting. One thing you were telling me a couple of weeks ago, I remember we were chatting and you were saying one success you have had recently was with some rent increases. What's been going on with that?
Yeah, that was really interesting because I think one of the things I used to do with my tenants was I used to keep the rent the same from the day they moved in. So whatever rent they rented the property at, I just continued to rent it at that rate, which... Right. It's not too much of a big deal, I guess, when you're renting a property to someone for a couple of years or something like that. It doesn't really matter too much. But when you have some tenants who've been with you for a lot longer, it starts to make a big difference. And I, having been on the Cuppa podcast, on the Cuppa meeting on a Saturday morning, I got into a conversation with some people on there, and I mentioned that was, we were just going to a chat about increasing the rent, and I came off it and thought, I'm going to put my rent up. It's about time I put my rent up. So I'd got the person I was speaking to at the time gave me some ideas of how I could do it, and which really revolved around writing a letter to the tenant and telling them that my intention was to increase the rent. And one of the things I did was I also included in this letter proof of how much it would cost to rent a similar property in the area. So I found maybe two or three properties in the area that were similar-ish, that if their person went to rent them, it would cost them an amount of money to rent. And I gave people a choice. They either accept the rent increase or they give me 30 days notice that they want to leave the property. And I was a bit cautious with it because I didn't know how much this would affect people when I sent it to them. So what I did was I got a batch. I started off in batches of something like, I think I sent them out in about six at a time. So I started with, because I figured, well, if six people move out, well, I can deal with that. But I don't want, if I had a mass exodus of everybody, then that would be a problem. So I started with six and I sent out the six letters and I waited. And a few days later, I started to get signed acceptance letters from people accepting the rent increase. So I then did another batch and did the same. And I got people accepting. And I just kept repeating that process as I worked through all the properties that had not had rent increases for quite a while. And I then, once I'd written all the letters, I then found there were some people that were, they were not too keen to send the letter back. They weren't in a rush to pay me more money. So some of those people I needed to chase, and I was told that, oh yes, I've signed the letter, but it's stuck on my fridge with a magnet or something like that. You know, it's ready to go, but I've not sent it to you. I'll send it to you. So I got some of those people sending them back to me. And then I also came across some people who resisted a little bit. I had some people write to me and told me that they were in extreme poverty and they couldn't afford it, and which wasn't true, by the way. And they were, you know, they tried to resist putting the rent up and made me lower offers and said, well, look, it just seems a ridiculous increase. How can you justify that increase? And actually what I did then was, one of the other things I did in any case in the letter, I actually worked out from the day they'd moved into the property to now, how much does it represent on an annual basis as a percentage?
Sure.
And the human mind has a flaw in it, in that it doesn't understand compound interest. So if you keep compounding a small amount over a period of time, people are quite surprised by the outcome. So if I said to people, well, look, this rent increase represents a 2 or 3% increase since you moved into the property, it's actually a fairly reasonable amount. You've probably had a pay rise of 2 or 3% every year since you moved in. So I'm not charging you any more than you were being charged back then. So it seems like a good deal. Sure. And with the people that resisted it, what I did was I developed that even further, and I actually created a table showing them how much money they'd saved each year that I hadn't increased the rent. And for some of my tenants, that was like £8,000 to £10,000 of rent that I didn't charge them because I hadn't increased the rent since they'd moved into the properties.
Yeah.
So to me, it just seemed like a logical way of presenting the information. And that helped with quite a few of them, that eventually they came back and said, okay, I'll pay you the extra. And then I had one or two who still resisted me. And I just said to them, look, you've got a choice. If you don't want to live in the property, that's fine. Because at that point, I got to the point where I was confident that most of the people had accepted. In fact, everyone had accepted the rent, and I increased the rent by, I successfully increased the rent on all of my properties, and I ended up getting about an extra £50,000 a year in rent out of that £55,000 a year in rent as a result of the increases. And only one tenant has decided that they don't want to pay the price for the property, and they've moved out. So I see that as an incredible success. And I did all of that thanks to the Cuppers property meet every Saturday morning.
From 9 to 11 at the cup of coffee shop in Salford Keys. That's an amazing thing, isn't it? I was thinking in my head, what am I going to get now is someone writing in going, well, I own one house, so I heard your podcast, and I put the rental £55,000, but it hasn't worked, and they've left. So you point out, first of all, it is an incredible achievement. Second of all, you know, this is the kind of thing we chat about, Cooper, is how to make sure that tenants generally have been well managed amongst, as long as just having chats with people. So do come along if you're in the area, or catch the online meeting. But also, it's about doing things the right way, isn't it? And you've done it the right way there, because it's about giving people information and you know, doing all the right paperwork, and but also about managing the properties properly, because now you're getting a proper rent. You're able to, well, first of all, look after the portfolio better, and second of all, maybe look for new opportunities for yourself. And you know, this isn't a charity we're in; it's a business. That's a great success.
It is, and I think it's very easy as a landlord. I've heard over, you know, I've talked to other landlords about it, and sometimes they'll say, well, you know, you almost become friendly with the tenant.
Sure.
And I think there's a danger that you obviously you've got to be friendly to the tenant, but at the same time, you've got to recognize you are running a business and you're not social services. You're not there to substitute, subsidize their life right. with a below market rent.
Yeah.
And when there's a strong rental market, which there has been for the last 12, 18 months or so, if you know that you can rent that property for more money and there's you're going to get 20 people wanting to rent it off you when you advertise it, it doesn't make sense to charge less. You might as well find a better another tenant.
That's absolutely right. I think you can be, I think you have been too, by the way, from what I can tell. And you absolutely should be nice to tenants because they're our clients and they look after us and put food on the table. But at the same time, my dad has a nice phrase, which I think I've stolen and I'm going to pretend it's mine very soon, which is that you should be friendly with your tenants, but they're not your friends. There's a difference. And it is a difficult one because you have a relationship with these people and often they're very, very nice people. Not always, but often very, very nice people. And you have a responsibility of care, but you're not their friends. You're there to offer it to make sure they've got everything they need and to collect the rent in return. Smashing. Well, I've that probably brings us towards a close. One question that I said I was going to ask and haven't yet, I don't think, unless I've asked it and forgotten it, which was you interviewed 2,000 people on your podcast so far, roughly speaking, or more. What have we talked about this briefly before we started recording? What have you learned from it? One thing I think that's difficult to one reason that's difficult to answer that question is because it's because it's so broad. And how do you fit in the learnings from 2,000 interviews into one glib answer? I think that's incredibly tricky.
It is. So I could decline to answer that question on that basis, couldn't I? Or, and then I think to myself, well, did you answer me the question earlier? And my answer was so profound, you don't even remember the answer.
Yeah.
Well, actually, it's actually a complicated question. I mean, success is something success to me, fascinates me. What is it that makes one person successful and another person not?
Yeah.
You know, people might think, well, that's money. Some people think it's about money, but it's not about money because there's many people who start with zero and end up doing very well. I started from working as a glass collector in a nightclub, being paid £2 something an hour. I didn't come into a huge fortune to allow me to do what I did. I literally started from zero. And what I found when I've asked lots of people is that it sort of struck me that actually I don't think most people really know what the secrets to success are. In fact, I actually asked that question, what is the secret to success? Or what do you think are the secrets to success? And people will say to me, well, it's determination, it's persistence, it's, you know, and they'll come up with various things, but, you know, you can be persistently wrong. You can persistently pursue something that isn't working. So clearly persistence isn't necessarily. And I've thought about this quite a bit. And I think my best answer to this, I think, is capacity. I think the secret to success is capacity, because you have to have, in anything that you do in life, you have to have the capacity to be able to, in your mind, you've got to have the capacity to believe that you're able to achieve that thing. Whatever it is, whatever you want to set out to do. So if you want to own 50 properties or 100 properties, if you don't believe it's a possibility, then you'll fail before you even start. So you've got to make it all right for you. It's got to be all right for you. It doesn't matter what anyone else says. You've got to believe that it's possible for you to achieve that thing and be absolutely unshakable in your belief on that. But capacity is also about education. You've got to educate yourself. You've got to be prepared to let go of who you are and become a new version of yourself that's going to allow yourself to actually create that possibility in the future. If you cling on to your past and who you were or who you are right now, if who you are right now has only got you to where you are right now, then clearly to get to where you want to be, there's going to be a gap between where you are and where you want to be. So you have to fill that gap or bridge that gap. And that's about increasing your capacity mentally to be able to achieve that thing. Mentally, you've got to learn how to do the thing. And you've got to do whatever it takes. And if you have that belief, then you really can achieve whatever you want to achieve because you'll find the way. And I think that's probably my takeaway from it, Tom, without going too deeply into it, unless you want me to go more into that.
I think that's a perfect level of depth and one of the more profound answers we've ever had on the Cup of Coffee podcast. And I think an excellent place to wrap it up, because I'm pretty sure it's downhill from there and we're just going to be talking about slumlords or something. I think we'll wrap up there. Thank you all very much for listening. As always, really appreciate your time. Special thanks to our speaker today, Neil Ball, or guest might be a better word. Really appreciate Neil, you taking the time, and I hope people have taken a fraction of it away of what I have. Look forward to seeing you all next time, and have a good one.